Thank you for joining us for the August 2023 reading of the Model Railroad Magazine. My name is Raymond Wallander. Today I will be reading miscellaneous articles, including letter from the editor. So we begin this morning with the Tinkerers and Mad Scientists Are Wanted. Model railroading is a hobby of tinkering and experimenting. Its roots come from engineering, trying to work out huge construction problems in the era long before digital computing. By the late 1800s, toy-making technology and experimental model building began to converge, and it became possible for hobbyists to begin imagining and building model railways for their own amusement. There, in the early decades of the 20th century, it was often necessary to combine toys with handmade items to create scale models. By the 1930s, it was becoming easier to find scale model products, and this magazine started as a result of the surge in interest in the new hobby of model railroading. At the time, it was still largely a hobby of machinists and craftsmen who had the skills and tools necessary to make what they wanted. They soon started to sell off excess stock, and companies such as longtime advertiser William K. Walters formed to distribute this bounty. The first golden age began, and hobbyists could buy components to build scale models of locomotives and rolling stock. Getting your train to run was often a matter of the builder's ingenuity. Car batteries were common power sources, but there were modelers who built railroads using household 120-volt AC current to run their trains. Going up to the attic to run trains must have had a bit of Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory feel to it. After World War II, advances in manufacturing, especially in miniaturization, plus a booming economy, fueled the second golden era of model railroading. Now, we go out and buy just about anything we want, from super detailed locomotives to detailed lighted structures to digital control for our model trains. Are we still tinkerers? Yes. Model railroading is a complex hobby combining multiple areas of expertise, and even though we can purchase off-the-shelf components, we still have to figure out how to get them to work together. Sometimes it takes the craftsman approach to get different brands of track to fit together when no one company offers all of the turnout configuration your layout needs. Sometimes it takes an electronic specialist to get multiple types of circuits to get a train to traverse a complex track plan. Sometimes we need to learn a bit of chemistry so that perfect paint and weathering job comes out just right, or all of those different types of materials stay together in the latest multimedia kit. This will always be a hobby that encourages exploration, whether it's tinkering to get a train through a turnout or whipping up a batch of casting resin for a lake or stream. We're all tinkerers and mad scientists. Have fun. And that comes again from editor Eric White. Next up, Ron Smith found that a technique for building crossovers described by Larry Puckett in our May issue also works for multi-track crossings. So technique makes diamonds easy, too. Larry Puckett's article on quick and easy crossovers, step by step, May of 2023, provided a nice track laying tip. I can confirm the technique works on Atlas N-Scale Code 55 track, as I have done the same thing with a pair of number 7 turnouts, although I omitted the wiring step. After doing that successfully, I also tried it with a pair of Atlas Diamond crossings. I have a junction where a single track bent branch line crosses a double track main line using two 50 degree crossings. This was a little fussier than the turnouts, but the techniques Larry described worked very well for this situation, and I want to thank him. From Ron Smith of DeBow, Pennsylvania. Well, for some news and reviews, let's look high tech at the TCS CS-105 DCC system. Last month, I reviewed the new TCS LT150 digital commands control layout command control system. This month, we'll look at its more advanced CS105 DCC LCC system. To my knowledge, the LT50 and the CS105 are the first DC systems to actively support both LCC and Railcom. Let's start by exploring the attributes of the TCS CS105. The CS105 is an advanced command station. It supports 9,999 locomotive addresses, 2,044 accessory addresses, and decoder functions 0 to 28. The integrated booster is powered by either a 12 or 15 volt DC power supply rated at 6 amps provided with the unit. This allows the CS105 to supply track power at either 12 or 15 volt and a full 5 amp. Unlike most boosters, TCS says the unit can operate at the full 5A continuously. Other DCC boosters only claim a peak output but require additional ventilation for continuous operation at or near peak. The advanced circuitry allows the CS105 to control up to 260 locomotives and consist. Of course, this really is a theoretical value based on processing power, since it would require something on the order of 65 amps or more to power that many locomotives. One other interesting feature is the ability to set up and control up to 300 10-step macros. These could be used to line routes through yard ladders or complex trackage using a single macro command. The CS105 supports both programming on the main and service mode programming. A separate pair of screw terminals are provided for a service mode programming track. The unit supports the National Model Railroad Association, NMRA, Railcom standard, which allows the command station to communicate bidirectionally with decoders. This allows you to read back CV settings from the decoder, even when using programming on the main. In the future, Railcom will allow computer programs to track the location of locomotives on layouts and report other information such as locomotive speed and direction. However, it does require decoders that support Railcom, which doesn't include many decoders already installed and available in the United States. The only commonly used decoders in the United States with Railcom are those from TCS and LockSound. Layout Command Control, LCC, was developed to serve as a parallel communication and control system. The basic idea is it reduces the need for the DCC power bus to operate accessories, freeing up its resources for operating locomotives. However, it also potentially makes it easy to mix DCC components from various systems on the same layout, including throttles. Throttles are an important aspect of any DCC system, and the CS105 offers several ways to connect them. First is the yet-to-be-released hardwired TCS T50 throttle. It will plug directly into one of the LCC sockets on the CS105 or an expansion throttle network. A second option is to use one of the TCS wireless Wi-Fi throttles, such as the UWT50 or the UWT100. These can connect directly to the CS105 via its built-in Wi-Fi interface. A third option is to use the auxiliary network socket on the rear of the unit. You may see the photo on an opposite page, not here, to connect throttles from NCE, Ramtrax, System 1, Lenz, Roco, or ZTC. Finally, should you wish to use one of the Wi-Fi apps such as Y-Throttle or Engine Driver on a cell phone or tablet, then the computer that requires connecting through Decoder Pro via a wireless router. You can see this month's DCC circuits to learn more on that topic. The last option requires some complicated setup, since you must access the CS105 system settings. I used my UWT100 throttle for that. Once in the system setting menu, you need to locate the internet address assigned to the CS105 by your wireless router and enter that in the LCC preferences in Decoder Pro. This complex process wasn't completely covered in the TCS documents, and I had to contact tech support for assistance in finding the internal internet address. I hope TCS will provide more detailed instructions for this process, either in a revised version of the manual or on its website. One thing made clear from this process is that one of the TCS throttles is almost a necessity for using the CS105. While you can connect to a computer using the internal Wi-Fi to access many of the C105's features, it's much easier using the menu-driven approach with the UWT50 or the UWT100. Fortunately, TCS does offer special bundles on its website that include these throttles at a reduced price. While the UWT50 and the UWT100 throttles, B106 booster and BA100 booster adapter are available, some other devices are still under development. The B106 is an LCC-compatible 5-amp booster. The BA100 makes it possible to use boosters from other manufacturers with a CS105. In addition, RR Circuits makes a variety of LCC accessories that are compatible with the CS105. These provide the ability to connect to a Digitrax LocoNet and use the Digitrax throttles and other LCC equipment. When it came to operating locomotives, I had no problem using either the TCS UWT100, NCE ProCab, my cell phone with a Y-Throttle app, or the virtual throttle in Decoders Pro. Locomotive response was quick and functions operated without any delay. Consisting that can be done using the usual basic and advanced methods, since that information is stored in the decoders. However, command station assisted consisting in just a bit different with the CS105 than with the most DCC system. TCS allows you to store a roster of locomotives and assign various functions to each, specifying how they operate alone or as part of a consist. In that respect, the TCS approach is similar to the advanced consisting, and the roster and consist information can be entered using a TCS throttle or a computer. Consists are then assembled using the throttle or computer. Both the roster and consist are stored in persistent memory in the command station. Once any locomotive is selected using a throttle, all the engines in that will respond. The CS105 is by far the most technologically advanced DCC/LCC system manufactured today. The extensive list of features and the wide variety of throttles supported should make it popular with the clubs as well as power users who want the latest technology. However, be ready to do some reading as you climb the learning curve. For a video demonstration, go to CS105, visit my YouTube and channel, The DCC Guy. And that comes to you from Larry Puckett, contributing editor. Well, let's turn to a question as we ask MR. Before covered hoppers became a popular way to ship grain in the 1960s, railroads hauled it in boxcars, either in sacks or in bulk, with the grain held back by grain doors nailed over the door openings. So it wouldn't have been unusual for a smaller business like Sudam's Purina Chows to receive its wares in sacks and not have an unloading crate or chute. Larger and busier industries received grain in bulk and boxcars fitted with grain doors, made at first of reusable wood planks, then later of single-use paper and cardboard designs, all were used into the 1970s. Grain doors were secured inside the openings of boxcar doors, covering them about three-quarters of the way up. Loading chutes were then poked through the openings, and the grain was poured inside. When these boxcars arrived at their destination, the grain doors were removed and the grain poured out. How the grain got from the boxcars to the business elevator varied. Some had an unloading grate next to the building alongside the tracks. This grate would be protected from dirt, weather, and vermin with ground-level doors that would be closed when not in use. Since a spectator's view of the grate would be blocked when a car was spotted alongside the grate itself, need not be remodeled, just the closed doors. Other such businesses had different unloading methods. Scheller Feed Company, a prototype dealer that was the subject of an article in our August 2009 issue, had an unloading chute that folded down from the side of the building. When open, it extended under the doors of the boxcar to catch the grain. However, when it was closed, the chute just looked like a Y-shaped panel on the side of the building. Adding a piece of strip wood representing a closed unloading chute to your kit would be a simple matter. Next, from Cheryl Sassy, we have a step-by-step instruction on how to model white pines. As company arborist for the On 30 Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes Railroad, I've been busy constructing trees over the past few years. In the April 2019 issue of Model Railroader magazine, I described my techniques for building hardwoods. In the March 2020 issue, I shared my methods for modeling white birch trees. I recently decided to try my hand at white pines for a grove of trees on the outskirts of Kingfield, Maine. The inspiration for this project came from Mike Confalone's HO scale white pines. Instead of using ground foam on his trees, Mike simulated pine needles with static grass flock. The finished trees were quite convincing. I adapted Mike's techniques and made a grove of old and new growth white pines for the SR and RI, though scratch building trees in time is time consuming, the finished products are worth the effort. Cheryl Sassy worked in the finance department for General Electric Company in Schenectady, New York for 32 years. She is the wife of Model Railroader contributing editor, Luz Sassy. So if you're ready to take the plunge and try Cheryl's ideas, here's a list of what you'll need. I used model the white pines. I used peppergrass stems, caspia, 18WG wire, floral tape, wire cutters, and scissors to shape the trees. I found the peppergrass, also referred to as sesame bloom, that I used for hardwoods from Teresa's plants and more 800-803-8056, teresamckessler@gmail.com. I ordered the caspia used for evergreens from Save on Crafts. Aerosol products used for the project include Rust-Oleum Painter's Touch 2 times Semi-Gloss, Hunter Green, and Stops Rust Satin Spruce Green, as well as Testor's Dull Coat. In addition to spray paint, I used Mars Black, a raw umber, and White Tube Acrylics and Model Master Earth Engine Black, Reefer White, and Roof Brown. Testor Corporation discontinued the Model Master line in April 2020, but similar colors are available from Acrylics Vallejo and Tamiya assorted brushes and a metal palettes around the paint brushes. I used Hecky number 3362 dark green static green flock for pine needles. I applied the fibers with a notch Grassmaster. Among the hand tools you'll need are a hobby knife with a number 11 blade, a pen vise with a number 68 bit, a plastic stylus, and a ruler. General purpose items include hairspray, facial tissue, wood glue, a block of foam, and water. Next up, this is a story of an old model railroader and a broke and broken down railroad. The Narragansett Railroad, the 18 by 24 foot on 30 layout, is set in Rhode Island between 1929 and 1935. This is my seventh and final model railroad. I started off with N scale, then built two HO scale layouts. After that, I moved on to own three, indoor G scale, a GN15 diorama, and finally, own 30. Finding the fun. First, understand that I've never been much into operating layouts. I'm more interested in scenery. Without towns and such, there would be no need for a railroad to service empty space. As construction progressed, my friend Dave and I started out wiring with all new, easy-to-install switch machines and stuff. At first, I thought that would be exciting. I was wrong. After spending three work sessions trying to get everything to work, I threw in the towel. This was not going to happen. I took a step back and thought about the happiest time I had as a model railroader. The answer was easy. When I was about 7 years old, I saw what I thought was the biggest model railroad ever. My friend Don and his brothers arranged three 4x8 sheets of plywood in a U-shape. That was just what I wanted. What was holding me back? I had all the room to build a layout almost in the same U-shape, only larger, and in what is thought of as a doghouse. With only 8 turnouts, half of which are in the engine yard, and within arm's reach, why not use ground throws? The turntable could be manually operated too. The layout height is 57 inches tall, a little taller than most. I chose this for two reasons. First, I wanted to avoid viewing it from above and seeing 25% or more of the layout at one time. Second, I wanted to preserve the various super detailed scenes around the layout. A side benefit of the height is that it gives forced perspective. This really makes the layout seem larger than just 24 by 22 feet. And doing things differently, I must give credit to three people, Martin, Gary, and Dave. Martin, Gary, and I started the Syracuse workshop years ago, along with our friend Brian, who has sadly since passed. I've always tried to do things a little different and with a lot of humor. I always try to avoid the loop look, which every model railroader has no matter how big or small. My layout still goes from one end to the other. However, in order to do that, the track is laid close to the front edge, then loops around and runs behind the buildings, fences, and scenery on the black edge, thus making a seam larger than it really is. It also allows me to have a mainline run of 150 feet. The all-around scenery, one of my hobby strengths, is realistic scenery. One motto I've followed is, nothing looks real as real. I'm frugal, to say the least. The main ground covers is real dirt, sifted down into a powder. I then apply white glue and spread it unevenly. With the glue still wet, I sprinkle in the dirt. Once the dirt is applied, I spray it with one aerosol hairspray that I buy at a dollar store. After that's dry, I apply an India ink wash here and there. If you're live in an area that has damp or moist air and shade, go outside and find some green moss. You'll quickly notice that the moss has many different shades of green. It's not uniformly shaped either. Grab it. That, to my best understanding, it gets moisture out the air. Should it ever dry out and turn brown, just stain it with a light green ink and alcohol. In addition to dirt and moss, I also use wild brushes, shrubs, and weeds. However, I don't use the parts that are visible above ground. Instead, I use their roots. The root structure, which is stiff, has a shape similar to trees. Most are shades from brown to gray. I spray the roots with aerosol glue and sprinkle on different shades of the fine ground foam. This technique yields realistic and affordable trees, though plastic and other artificial products are okay. Most have a uniform shape and color. And don't forget that roots can represent dead trees too. Leafless trees add interest to wooded scenes. Looking at the photos, you might notice that most everything is broken down. The Narragansett Railroad is financed by the Sault City Locomotive Works. The company's president, Dave Wierowski, always seems to purchase secondhand junk. Examples include the coal loader that we didn't need and never got running, the sanding loader that just dumped sand on the ground, and the double water tank that leaked so badly it flooded the area. The Climax locomotive that was going to save the railroad a lot of money lasted about a week. It did come in handy when the diesel generator that ran the electricity on the railroad and to some of the businesses in the area broke down. The workers in the area are still trying to figure out how to hook that back up. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader, August 2023. My name is Raymond Wallander.